For the week of March 4th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 139, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, Michael, have you recovered from your Oscar hangover?
I don't have an Oscar hangover.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Well, we'll only be talking about the Oscars a little bit on today's show. On today's show, we're actually going to be telling you how not to respond via email when your film is accepted by the South by Southwest Film Festival. We'll tell you what happened when one filmmaker responded. I guess he responded with a synopsis that was filled with profanity. And apparently, that might not be such a bad thing, and we'll explain why. We're also going to be taking a lot of time to talk about the state of the streaming music space. There are a lot of different services to choose from. As you know, Michael, there's Spotify, Rhapsody, Moog, Ardio, and a ton of others. But I guess the question now, is there too much competition, and is the market primed for a major consolidation? Julie Taymor, you remember who she is, Michael?
I do. The director of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark at one point.
At one point, that's right. She was fired, and now she's back in the news. She's responding to a lawsuit against the producers of the Broadway musical, the troubled Broadway musical, as it is often called.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, yes. Apparently, all those troubles weren't her fault. We'll explain why and tell you what she had to say about that. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll not only cover all the big entertainment headlines, but we're going to be joined by our former host, Karen Woodward.
Yay.
First, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
All right. Well, the number one movie around the world is Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, which essentially opened in North America and did about $500,000 worth overseas. It grossed $71 million worldwide. In North America, that set a number of records. It's the biggest opening of the year by far. You know, it's only March, but still it was a very strong opening. It's the third biggest March opening of all time behind Alice in Wonderland, starring Johnny Depp, and 300. It's the biggest animated film opening of all time, I think, if the numbers hold up, for an animated movie that's not a sequel, like Toy Story 2 or something like that, or Shrek.
That's right. It beat out The Simpsons, right? So I guess if you look at it, though, you have The Simpsons, which used to hold the record, and it kind of had a built-in audience because of the television show. And then you have Dr. Seuss, The Lorax, again, kind of a built-in audience because it's been a beloved children's book for decades. So all of these films have built-in audiences.
The Simpsons had the record? I thought it was like Toy Story or something. No,
it was The Simpsons.
No, not Toy Story. It was The Simpsons?
Yes, an animated film opening that was not a sequel.
What was The Simpsons record?
I have no idea. I will check while you continue.
All right. I saw another movie, and it was edging it out by like $500,000 or something. So, you know, the numbers were still not clear. But there you go. You maybe know better than I. The number two movie around
its
the world.
Its opening, by the way, The Simpsons opening, $74 million.
So it's not beating that.
It's not beating that. No, it's still second to The Simpsons.
I guess it's now we could say it's an animated standalone movie. Well, no, it's based on a book. The Simpsons is a spinoff from a TV show, so it's the same thing. So, Dr. Seuss had a very strong opening.
And do you think we've bored our listeners to
number
tears
two,
now?
Number two around the world is Journey to the Mysterious Island. It grossed $21 million worldwide. It's at $270 million and counting. And number three around the world is Project X, which is a fake found footage high school party flick about kids in high school throwing a crazy party that gets out of control. It grossed $20 million in North America only. That's the only place it opened. And that's a terrific opening for a movie that cost about $12 million to make.
Now, let me ask you something. Is fake found footage high school party flick a new genre? Because that's
no, it's not.
Okay.
At number four is This Means War, which grossed another $20 million. It's at $84 million and counting. And number five is Safe House, starring Denzel Washington. It grossed another $18 million worldwide. It's at $159 million and counting. And number six is The Act of Valor, the military movie. That grossed another $13 million. It's at $45 million and counting. And number seven is Hugo, which got a good Oscar boost. It's grossing $11 million worldwide. It's at a still paltry $123 million and counting. It still has not matched the budget of the film, even with its worldwide box office figures.
And when you think about it, you know, most movie theaters keep 50% of the gross, right? So it's $123 million worldwide. That means that the filmmakers and the studios will only wind up with $60 million so far.
That's right.
That's not so great.
No. At number eight is The Vow, the Channing Tatum, Rachel McAdams drama, which grossed another $10 million. It's at just under $150 million worldwide. At number nine is War Horse, which Sperling still hasn't seen. It grossed $10 million worldwide. It's at $158 million and counting.
And there's no place to see it in the United States. So, I mean, it's not playing on too many screens anymore.
Well, it's almost done, sure. I mean, yeah. It came out Christmas time or before Christmas, but it's winding down. This is March. That's not unusual. And number 10 is Chronicle, the teens with psychic powers movie. It grossed $8 million worldwide. It's at $105 million and counting. And then there's a 1-2-3-4-way tie at number 11. Four movies grossed $7 million. Tyler Perry's Good Deeds, The Devil Inside, which is a cheapo horror flick, which is now opening overseas. Jean Dujardin, the Oscar winner for The Artist, had a great week. His film won, you know, the Oscar. He won Best Actor. It won the César Awards. And his new movie, The Players, opened in France to a massive $7 million. And then there's a South Korean romantic drama called Love Fiction about a shy writer and his love. It's nice to think a writer could actually have a love interest. And that grossed $7 million in South Korea. So a strong showing from all those four movies around the world. And finally, we have The Artist at number 15. That grossed $6 million worldwide. It's at $82 million and counting. It, of course, got a good boost from winning the Best Picture.
Well, do you think at $82 million worldwide, we could bore our audience to tears by telling you that The Artist is now the highest grossing silent film of all time?
Oh, well, that's kind of interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
I made that up. I have no idea whether it's the highest grossing silent film.
Well, Mel Brooks had Silent Movie in the 70s, which was a pretty strong hit. That grossed something like $36 or $40 million, I think, in North America, which I think would probably make it one of the 10 biggest films of the year in that era. Certainly adjusted for inflation, I doubt that's true about The Artist. You know, there were massive hits back in the 10s and 20s. But as far as pure dollar gross, it's probably true.
Well, Silent Movie made $36 million lifetime. So, yeah, 1976 dollars.
That's in North America.
That's in North America, yes.
Right. And that's, yeah. So, I mean, we don't have overseas grosses for those movies back in the day. They didn't tend to get released as much. The one big thing I noticed looking at the box office is how low the budgets are that studios are citing right now. I've mentioned this before, but I mean, we know Act of Valor is a movie with non-actors, and it was created as a training film video and was turned into a feature film. That cost $12 million to make. The Vow, though, only cost $30 million. This Means War, which is a pretty elaborate sort of spy, you know, romantic comedy, cost $65 million. Dr. Seuss's The Lorax, this is an animated film from a major studio. They say it cost $70 million. Now, it's been years since we've seen a major studio animated film. Typically, they cost like $100 million or $150 million or $200 million.
Well, they're only $200 million when they're like sequels to big films like Toy Story 3.
But no, it's not because the actors don't get a ton more money. It's only because the budgets are getting bigger and bigger. It's hard to do. I'm just suspicious about these box office figures for the budget. I just don't believe The Lorax only costs $70 million. I think everybody's making a concerted effort to present themselves as more cost conscious and more reasonable. Because there was a while when you couldn't make a romantic comedy for less than $60 or $70 million, not if you're with a big studio. But Ghost Rider, the Nicolas Cage movie, only costs $57 million to make. I just find this intriguing. I think studios are trying. There was a period when they would say our movie costs $130 million because they thought it sounded good. Now I think it sounds good to them to say that their movies are made for a dime.
Well, right. They basically want to say, look, we're being cost conscious in these hard economic times when you, moviegoer, are having trouble even affording a movie ticket. We, too, are cutting back.
And yet we'll still put it in 3D and charge you extra.
Exactly. And I think that they're also, you know, they're also going for these movies that they're either they have built-in audiences like The Lorax or they're Project X where they're going to spend $5 million and make it for nothing and hope that it breaks out on its opening weekend and they make all their money opening weekend.
When you look at a summer movie tentpole or an animated film, $70 million still strikes me as quite inexpensive. So it's interesting.
But, you know, a movie like This Means War, they say they spent $65 million on the budget. Figure they put another $40 million into...
Well, that goes without saying.
Right.
That they're going to spend money on advertising. That's not the issue.
So they're already claiming up to $100 million. They've only made 41.
No, we're talking about the money they claim they're spending on the budget. We know that P&A costs a lot of money. And not prints, you know, and advertising. And that's a different issue, how much it costs to promote a movie. They're claiming their budgets are more and more reasonable. The last year, I would say, 6-18 months, they've been really announcing very low budgets for their films, pretty much across the board, whether it's a big picture, medium-sized picture, or a little picture. There was a period 5-8 years ago where every movie cost $60, $70 million.
Right, right. But what I'm saying is even a film like This Means War...
We know that advertising costs money.
No, what I'm saying is they lost money because they only made 41 in North America.
But they're not done yet.
Yeah, I guess on what they made.
Yeah, but they lost less money too.
They made $5.6 million. Yeah,
if it cost $80 million or $90 million, then of course that would mean, you know, they lost less money than they did when it only cost $60 million. But it's not done yet. It's not going to be a big moneymaker for them. But it's at $84 million worldwide. It's the number four movie around the world. It's still making $20 million a week, so it's still got some life left in it. It could be the sort of film that plays better overseas. So, you know, as always, we want to wait until the end, and you should wait until the next morning before hitting send on your emails.
Well, yeah, you're talking about this particular filmmaker, Jordan Roberts, whose film was accepted by the South by Southwest Film Festival, which begins at the end of this week. His film's name is Frankie Go Boom, and it was accepted. And they asked him via email, hey, can you send us a one-sentence kind of synopsis or blurb, kind of summing up the plot of your movie so that we can put it in press releases and in the catalog? And I guess it was late at night when Mr. Roberts got this email, and he was drunk, probably. I don't know what.
Why would you say he's drunk?
I'm just, you know, I'm kidding around. I don't know that he was drunk, but he was certainly, he's got a good sense of humor, because this is what he wrote. A flick by Bruce about his little brother Frank, who's a crybaby bleep. So there's a profane word there. Who should
crybaby F, who shouldn't do effing embarrassing effing F if he doesn't want people to see it.
and two is the number two. So he wakes up the next morning and realizes the grave mistake he's made by actually hitting send on his on that note. And he called up the festival and said, please don't publish that. I'll send you another one. And he sent another one, another log line along that was a little bit cleaner, probably far more boring than the one he originally sent. But apparently, nope, that didn't get to the right person. And the profanity-laden logline, the synopsis with all of those curse words in it, yeah, that made the catalog and that made the press release. And you'd think that would be the beginning of the end for Mr. Roberts, but indeed it's not.
Well, of course, people thought it was funny. It caught their attention. It caught their eye. They all saw that and giggled and said, hey, I want to see that movie. And now it's one of the buzz must-see movies of South by Southwest.
Yeah, I mean, I've always wanted to go to South by Southwest. It just comes at the worst time of year. It's in March. It's, you know, a month before or the month of Show West and now CinemaCon, and then, you know, Cannes is right after. It comes at a really bad time. But one of these days, I'd like to actually attend and see what they're up to over there.
And if you do, you'll want to see a movie that sounds pretty effing funny.
You're absolutely right. But you know what wasn't funny this week? No matter what you thought of the Monkees, Davy Jones passed away.
Yes, that's true. No matter what you thought of the Monkees, one of them died this week. Yes,
well,
that's
okay,
true.
You're
he
right.
He was the cute monkey, the British monkey. And
I didn't actually follow through on that thought. But no matter what you thought of the Monkees, you still don't want to hear about.
Well, what does anyone think of the Monkees? They had some great pop singles. They were, you know, vilified at the start, beloved by teenage girls, and ultimately gained a little respect because they ultimately played their own instruments, wrote their own songs, did some cool stuff like the movie Head. And I think they've obviously by now long had revivals and a reappreciation of the great songwriters that wrote the music that they sang in their early tracks, like Neil Diamond and the Brill Building People. So I think the idea that they're sort of a joke has ended in about 1969.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea that Neil Diamond was writing some of those songs.
Oh, sure. I'm a believer. Yeah, that's one of their biggest hits. Yeah, of course. Yeah, that might be the only Neil Diamond song they covered, but they had Brill Building artists, they had top-notch songwriters, you know, providing them with music, as most rock stars did throughout most of the early rock era in the 50s and 60s. It was the Beatles that changed that. The Beatles who said, hey, we write our own songs, even though their early albums had some covers on them by, I want to say A Hard Day's Night. I think that might be Beatles for Sale was the first album. I'm going to make this up and I'm not sure.
I thought it was Meet the Beatles was their first album.
No. Their first album where they wrote all their own songs.
Oh, okay.
It might be Beatles for Sale. It might be A Hard Day's Night. Somebody will email in and tell me. But whatever it was, they changed the idea of rock stars to where the point where people almost never for a while would be considered cool unless they wrote all their own songs.
So they helped create the singer-songwriter.
Yes. Well, the singer-songwriter is a slightly different thing. That's a different vibe. But yeah, if you're a serious rock star, you're supposed to write your own music. That was the idea for a while and still holds true today for rock in general. But you'll have a lot of pop stars now like the late Whitney Houston or Mariah Carey or other people who write some songs, co-write others, and take in other songs from other people. Never held sway in country music, of course. But there you go. The Monkees had gained critical love, you know, had big revivals, and, you know, he's dying quite young, I guess, of heart condition or something.
Yeah, he had a heart attack. Now, don't you think that Bob Dylan also helped usher in that era where rock stars would write their own music?
Yes, he did. But, you know, he had covers on his first album, too, in 63. You know, it was the Beatles that sort of changed the idea for everybody. Dylan was sort of in the folk world at first, where people did write their own songs. In rock, everybody, you know,
covered other
had
music,
songs
yeah.
written. But yeah, Elvis didn't write anything. He got some credits, but you know, because he demanded them. But essentially, he didn't write his own music, and that was considered fine. And in the folk world, everybody wrote their own songs. A lot of them did, I should say. They covered other songs as well in the great body of folk music. But no, I mean, Dylan was not the first folk person to write his own songs. Woody Guthrie wrote all his own songs. But in the rock world, it was considered fine to not write your own music until the Beatles.
Now, you know, for people such as myself, born in the early 70s, born in, you know, 1971.
Born in the USA, as Bruce Springsteen would say.
Well, yes, that too. But how do you think I was introduced to the Monkees and Davy
MTV.
Jones? No. Although, yes, you're right. As far as the Monkees proper, yes, it was MTV when they started re-airing their show. But it was on the Brady Bunch when Marcia, one of the characters on the show, was, you know, I guess the president of the Davy Jones fan club in her school. And she promised everybody at school that she could get Davy Jones to appear and sing at the school. That's how I was introduced. I was like, who is this Davy Jones guy?
Well, at that point, they weren't that big a deal anymore anyway. But no, they were still sort of cool. You know, that was one of the more famous, you know, TV cameos in the 70s. He even popped up in one of the Brady Bunch movies. Was it the first one? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
But there you go. Yes, no, they were pop cultural icons for a while and still well remembered today. I think if you get a greatest hits album by them, you're set. But hey, that's better than a lot of bands.
Now, do you know one of the little trivia bits about one of the members of the Monkees, Mike Nesmith?
Well, his mom helped develop liquid paper.
Yes, Whiteout. That's right. Okay, so then since everybody seems to know that, that's no longer a good
that's
part.
That's right. So if you wanted to listen to the Monkees music right now, where would you go? Would you go to Spotify? Would you go to Pandora? Where would you go?
Well, you know, I had a feeling you would be asking me that, Michael. So actually, as you were asking, I was looking up. And indeed, the Monkees are on Spotify, which I'm a member of, or I subscribe to at least their lower tier offering. I guess I could also find them on Pandora.
Yep, they're on there.
So, you know, I don't know where I'd turn to listen to the Monkees, but certainly there are more than enough places to turn. There's Spotify, there's Rhapsody, there's Mog, there's RDO, there's... What am I forgetting here?
Deezer, Slacker, Groove Shark.
Yeah, if Groove Shark is even still around, that's true. But, you know, it looks like Mog is for sale. According to Greg Sandoval over at CNET, the numerous sources in the digital music sector, as he says, have said that the Mog, which is another one of these subscription streaming music services, is for sale and possibly in financial trouble. The founder of Mog, David Hyman, says, no, we're not actively trying to sell the business. The reality is we're not yet profitable, and we're always engaged in conversations with our shareholders about all possible options. And they have 500,000 regular users.
How does that compare to like Spotify and Pandora?
Well, Spotify is well over 2 million. I think they're up to 2.5 million. Mog has been around since 2005. Spotify's been around since 2009. It just goes to show you that, you know, as a startup, getting all that press and publicity works.
And being first doesn't always mean you're going to be best.
Look, it's really, really hard in this space right now. There's so many different services we just mentioned.
And they're too similar, right?
Yeah. I mean, so really, the real crux here is this is going to have to consolidate. You know, I mean, Mog has the same stuff as Spotify, has the same stuff as RDO, has the same music as Slacker. So, I mean, maybe Pandora is a little different, but for the most part, they all have the same music.
So there's no way to differentiate yourself, so other than price, so there's no way for them to stand out from one another. So there's, you know, no need for them all to be around.
This is a market that is ripe for consolidation, and the question is, which one of these companies and which one of these services is going to survive, and why? And even more so, is Apple or Amazon going to enter the marketplace? Right now they have these music locker type services. Will they start doing music streaming? Will Google start doing music streaming?
Can they afford to do it? That's another big question.
Well, that's true, actually, because, I mean, look, you have this guy, the lawyer from the general counsel, Cecily Mack, over at Rhapsody, which, of course, is one of these music streaming services.
He said when they were trying to talk about, you know, getting a new deal from major labels, that's one, someone that said, you got to give us a lot of money and a piece of your company if you want to have access to our music.
Right. And that's really where, look, if you want a lot of money from me for your product, okay, great. Here it is. You know, I'll license your product for a lot of money. But I can't pay you a lot of money and then give you a piece of my company. But I guess that's what the music companies are asking for. And he's saying it's completely prohibitive. And as he says, a brutal, brutal reality.
Well, they can't all survive. They need to reach more subscribers and make more money off of it and start being profitable.
Right. I mean, think about it. You have what? Comcast and Netflix are the two top subscription services in the United States, in North America. And they're at, what, like 25 million?
Yeah.
And in 2 years, you have Spotify already at 2.5 million. And I don't know that they're going to get above 10 million, but if they do, it'll be a big, big deal.
That'd be like equal to a major radio station in a major market.
Well, what, you think 10 million people are listening to a radio station in New York City? One radio station? One single radio station?
No, I'm saying they'd be the, whatever those radio stations are making in advertising, you've got to figure they're, you know, equal to or bigger than.
Oh, yeah, okay. That is true. Yes.
And that's a big business.
That is a big business. As is, you know, being a record label used to be a big business. And, you know, they're having a few issues these days, as we all know. And, you know, you might recall, Michael, Larry Roeder. Do you remember when we had him on from the New York Times and he discussed termination rights on episode 115?
That's where artists who created music for a record label found out that after 35 years, the music was going to revert back to them. They were going to retake control rather than having to die and let their estate do it eventually some years down the road.
Right. So you had, you know, Bob Dylan and I think it was Bob Seger for some
Rolling Stones and a bunch of people who have we looked at albums that came out in 1977 and said, hey, these could start to become accessible to the artist. They could seize control again in 2012.
That's right. Well, Michael Robertson is this entrepreneur and probably best known for starting MP3.com and then being sued out of existence by the record labels a decade ago. He then went on to start this service, MP3 Tunes, which, you know, kind of it's like this music locker and it has a search engine and you can go out and find and sideload different music that's already online. And
sideload? What does that mean?
Meaning it's not it's a technical term for you don't have the music. It's on a third party's website, and then you basically suck the music out of the third party's website and into your locker.
Okay. So he's being sued yet again.
He's being sued yet again by EMI and a number of record labels because of this. And, you know, he's, you know, they're arguing that, look, if you run a music locker site, you need to have licenses. You can't just do that. You can't just.
Which is crazy, because if you're saying if I buy a book or a movie and put it in a locker down at the local gym, the gym does not have to have a music licensing fee in order to let me put my physical copy of that book or movie or music in the locker. And they're saying, hey, this is a digital locker. You presumably own that music. You're putting it in your locker. Why should the locker owner have to get a licensing fee for your private possession?
And this has really brought up this whole issue of termination rights.
Well, I'm not quite sure how or why, but there is something to do with work for hire has come into play here, because a lot of record labels are trying to say now that, okay, yes, you know, Bob Seger created this album for us, but he doesn't own it because it was just a work for hire. We just paid him to create this album for us. Just like somebody else might have built your home. They don't get to own the home. You pay them to build your home. But once it's built, you own it, not them.
Right.
The problem with this is that Bob Seger and all these other artists typically have to actually pay for the album that they create. The record label loans you money in order to go into the studio and record an album, but you have to pay them back, and you have to pay them back for the production of it, and you have to pay them back to promote it and pay them back to market it. That's all money that they bill you for. So the argument that an artist is a work for hire is really hard to pull off. It's not like a movie where movies cost tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and the director does not pay the studio back for the, you know, the cost of the movie. So in the music industry, it's a very different situation. It's pretty hard to argue.
You know, you're right. They basically pay the artist to record, but what they're paying for is they then take back. They say, okay, well, we made, you know, $100,000 this week on your record, but you owe us, yeah, a certain amount. So we're not going to pay you any of that money because, you know, we paid to record your album. So effectively, the artist is paying for the recording sessions and the studio time and you know, all of the marketing costs of releasing that album.
So somehow in this court case about this digital locker, there's a possibility that the judge could rule on works for hire, because this goes into the question of whether you need to buy a license in order to have a digital locker.
Right.
So what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Writing on Hypebot, just to let our listeners know, Michael Robertson actually wrote a piece on Hypebot looking for an artist, any artist who would come and join him in this fight. And he says, for technical legal reasons, this is an issue, this work for hire. And it's in the upcoming MP3 Tunes trial, this same work for hire debate will be argued. If this incorrect designation holds up, then these artists will never get ownership and the future royalties that come along with it. In the MP3 Tunes case, we have a chance to get a ruling that these works are not works for hire, paving the way for these works to be returned to the artists without a multi-year battle, which will likely cost millions.
Right. And so if you follow the link that we have in our show notes, you'll find where he lists a bunch of artists that EMI has officially said, hey, all these people did works for hire. They didn't create the album. They don't own the album. We own the album because we brought them in as works for hire to create the album for us. And they list 100 or so artists, everyone from Adam Ant and Billy Idol to Blur and Bonnie Raitt and Bob Seger, on and on and on. All these artists who've written for EMI, and they claim, hey, none of those people own the rights to their albums. We do. They'll never revert to them because they're just works for hire. So it's kind of funny to see all these acts. And this guy's saying, hey, one of you come forward because we need to make sure that you don't get a bad ruling on this case because that could set a bad precedent.
Right. They, you know, basically Michael Robertson needs a couple of artists to take the stand and say, well, yeah, no, they. I had to pay the record company back for all the money they gave me to record the album.
Yeah, it's obviously a more complicated legal issue than we are putting it, but it's a very interesting question, and to us it seems very clear it's not a work for hire, but we'll have to see what happens. And you want to make sure you get all your ducks in a row whenever a potentially landmark case comes to the fore.
Well, now, speaking of landmark cases and speaking of work for hire, Julie Taymor, who is a theater and television director, not television, movie director, she's back in the news, and she, of course, was the director and author of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. That's the Broadway musical that was troubled and is no longer in trouble and is doing really well, and she was fired, and, you know, Michael, you know a lot about this.
Yes, I do. So they're back and forth. They had settled one part of the court case in order to let the show go forward, but there are other areas as far as royalties and things that they're still fighting over. And as part of the legal battle, she just released a bunch of emails and other information to sort of get her side of the story out. They obviously portrayed her as refusing to make any changes, difficult to work with, refused to acknowledge that the show was in trouble, absolutely, you know, adamant about not touching anything. And she wants to say, I was very reasonable and they were unreasonable. Some of the emails that she's put out are very, inflammatory. There's an indication that there was some creative meeting where Bono showed up as someone in the email says, drunk. With supermodels, and the meeting fell apart and never happened. Others where other people give sort of more of her side of the story about this person and that person. Also emails showing her saying, yes, I recognize this second act needs work and that needs to change and this needs to change. And she also says, hey, the show is essentially the same as what I created. And therefore, it's absurd to suggest it's brand new after just 3 weeks in a closed down shop. So she's saying, look, you want to go to court? It's going to get ugly.
Right. I mean, effectively, she actually went off on them. And she said that the Bono, the Edge, the producers of the show are actually assassinating her character and her professional reputation, which was their intent because they were trying to save this show that she had worked on for 5 years. So there's no way that in 3 weeks the whole thing could have been, quote unquote, reimagined.
Well, she's saying she wants her day in court. She says, if you don't give me what I deserve creatively, we're going to go to court and it's going to get ugly. You know, as she says, Bono and the Edge were on tour and they were not there as most composers would be. For a significant portion of the long, long previews. But they were not there to write new songs. They turned in their songs and were gone for a long time. And she said, normally you've got people there ready to write new songs, ready to deal with the problems and thing. And that wasn't happening. And she was saying, hey, we need new songs. You know, the songs need work. And frankly, a lot of the reviews would single the songs out as being particularly weak. And they weren't there for 8-9 months. They finally came back and did do some new songs, but that was after they sort of shoehorned her out of the show.
Right. So, and I think that, you know, when that was going on, I think I said to you on this show, gee, it's odd that Bono and the Edge are on tour when the show's...
Well, they had commitments. You know, they're a big multi-$100 million business, and they have already committed. And they were in the midst of one of the biggest tours in history, and they had already made clear that they were not going to be available to sit there day in and day out, for better or for worse. So she says, hey, look, there's more to this story than me being some, you know, intransigent lunatic who refuses to acknowledge problems with the show. Everybody had work to do. A lot of people weren't helpful. I can get ugly. You better pay me the money I'm worth.
Well, do you think that, I mean, she's saying that, look, they fired me because they wanted to please their existing investors and get new ones. They wanted to sway the public and critics' opinion to say, oh, well, they got rid of Julie Taymor, so now it's going to be a different show. And even though some of the early buzz might have been negative, it's different now, so it's going to be better. Do you find any of that to be true?
Well, it's certainly debatable. It certainly made the show look like it had a fresh start. You know, she was gone. That shows a certain drastic look. We're not, you know, like you fire a lead actor, you fire the director, you fire somebody big. That shows a serious commitment to redoing the show, as well as shutting it down for 3 weeks in the midst of previews, which is fairly unprecedented. So that clearly did indicate, look, we know there are big problems and we're trying to work on them. Whether she was the fall guy or a genuine creative block that they needed to get rid of, that's where the debate is. But there's no question that when you fire the director and shut the show down for 3 weeks in previews, that you're making a major statement that you're ready and willing and need to overhaul the show. The final fact is that the show's on Broadway. I don't have this week's figures yet. They haven't come out. But, you know, last week it was doing, you know, I think it did $1.3 million last week. We think the running costs are $1 million a week. So it's the third or fourth highest grossing show on Broadway. It's not filling up the house, but it's doing strong business. And it's grossing, or netting, I should say, a couple hundred thousand dollars a week at least. And so, you know, it's going to have to run for 5 years to make a profit in New York. But still, it's making money. And I should say, don't think this will stop anybody from adapting big, huge products and big, huge titles like Spider-Man, because I just got an email saying that there's a new Broadway musical version of Animal House in the works.
Ugh,
and I assure you, the Bare Naked Ladies are doing the music. I think they're Canadian, right?
Yes.
And I assure you that Josh Gad will, in fact, get the lead role of John Belushi in Animal House. There's no question in my mind that they plan to offer that role to Josh Gad, the star of the Book of Mormon. They want him to play the John Belushi role. I'm certain of it, but we shall see.
Well, I mean, do you think this court filing that Taymor has, sent in this past week, big deal, or you don't think it's going to amount to anything?
I think it's a big whoop because it's just her, you know, it's both sides are going to play nasty, and she's just doing what she needs to do in order to make the best case in the court of public opinion and to try and settle before they go to court.
Okay. Well,
but I know what you're really trying to do is segue.
Yes, indeed. I was trying to segue into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. This week, we're going to be joined by Karen Woodward. And for those of you who have been listening to the show for a while now, you'll remember Karen Woodward as, well, Karen, how should we describe you? Besides
the original co-host of Showbiz Sandbox.
Okay.
That works.
Now, Karen, how is life in the real world?
I don't know, actually, if you'd say I'm in the real world. You know that I spend like 95% of my time sitting in front of my computer, right? Like, my friends actually had an intervention. Karen, we're a little worried about you. We think you need to get out more.
Well. So,
I'm not kidding.
Anything exciting in your career you can share with us, or how are things going?
Things are great, actually. I am right now only focusing on doing social media for TV and entertainment properties. I'm lucky enough that that's all I'm doing right now.
So we should definitely start asking you about, you know, some inside dirt on all of these shows and these channels and networks. And
yeah, I absolutely know all of that. In fact, somebody the other day sent me a blog post for me to edit. And I looked at them. I'm like, your blog post is like, it's 5 years out of date. They were talking about social TV and, you know, stuff like that. And they didn't even know what to call it. You know, and they were so out of date that I surprise myself sometimes by how completely up to date I am.
You're so up to date, you know what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes.
I do. I absolutely do.
What's
on
your
Twitter.
Favorite, what's your
Damn
favorite
it.
TV show right now?
It was Downton Abbey.
Even season two?
Oh, yeah. No, we talked about this, I think, a little bit on Twitter. I did like season two. I thought it was different from season one. Which season one was a little bit more upstairs, downstairs, and it was a little bit more sophisticated and smart. Season two was it was too soapy, but by the time I watched it, you had already watched the whole thing. So I had seen your Twitter that it was nothing but, you know, a soapy mess. And I was like, all right, cool. Well, then, you know, I set my expectations. I knew it was going to be a soapy mess, so I was okay with it.
Well, I don't know what cleaning products have to do with Downton Abbey and a show on PBS, but
right.
Yes.
Hey, well,
hey, guess what, Karen? My jokes are just as good as they've always been.
They are bad.
Well, now, let me ask, do you watch The Office still? Does anybody watch The Office still?
No, I stopped watching it seasons ago.
Well, there's some news about The Office, and much like an office worker trapped in a boring, repetitive job, the NBC sitcom The Office keeps trudging along, even after its star...
James Spader leaves.
Well, ooh, yeah, that's what we're going to get to.
I don't even have the show notes, and I know what's going on.
That's right. Well, Steve Carell left last year, and he moved on, in, quote-unquote, into upper management, and, you know, also known, by the way, in the business, we call that Hollywood movies. That's what upper management is. James Spader, as you just mentioned, he by the way, I did not write that joke. You can thank Michael for that. He took over as the nominal head of The Office, so James Spader is now on the show. And throughout the entire eighth season, he has meandered all over the place with various characters taking the center. Well, actually, the eighth season has meandered all over the place, and nobody's really kind of the front runner or the lead character anymore. Some characters were even sent away to Florida. Now, the show's creative team says Spader won't be back, not because he didn't work out, but because they never really planned for him to last more than one season. And
yeah, right.
And, well, maybe not having a star of the show wasn't such a great idea either. Creatively, the series is dead, but NBC, they're in such dire straits, it will bring the show back for at least a ninth season, if not a tenth. In fact, if they could prop it up for an 11th, they probably would. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. They lost their way completely this season. Of course, if Jane Spader had worked out great and was having fun and it was doing well and goosed the ratings, they would have brought him back. In fact, this is the first season to not grow in the ratings. The show's never been a hit. Last season, I think the seventh season was ranked 52nd among all primetime shows. That was its best season ever. And now this season, it dropped back to 53rd. So it's not much of a fall, but it's never been a hit. It's the only show in history, and the only sitcom in history, to go eight seasons and never be in the top 40, never even be in the top 50. It's never happened before. But that's how low-rated NBC is.
Wow, I didn't know those numbers. That's interesting. I agree it's a big whoop for the same reason that you just said. The only big deal here is that NBC keeps stumbling with the people that they tried to replace Steve Carell with. They tried Will Ferrell. I mean, he had an arc, but let's be real. If he had clicked, they probably would have tried to at least get that guy out of movies. And James Spader, who doesn't even look like James Spader anymore. They stumbled pretty badly.
What is the deal with James Spader? I mean, I look at him and I'm just like, do you know that you used to be the hot guy? What happened to you?
I know. What was his name in Pretty in Pink? Michael, you'll know.
No, I don't.
No, he wasn't in Pretty in Pink, was he?
Yes, he was.
Sure,
he was the
yeah.
evil guy in Pretty in Pink.
I thought that Pretty was Andrew McCarthy or whatever his name was.
He was, well, no, but Andrew McCarthy was the love interest, and he was it Blaine? No, that was Andrew McCarthy's name. He was, quick,
Ducky.
Somebody look it up, it's going to kill me. He was the evil guy in Pretty in Pink, just the evil friend.
So you're saying he wasn't billed as evil guy?
No, he wasn't. He had some horrible name that sounded like a kitchen
James
appliance.
James Spader played Steph.
Yeah, he played Steph.
Yeah, Don Cryer played.
Oh, that's right. Blaine was the kitchen appliance.
And Andrew McCarthy was Blaine. Andrew McCarthy was Blaine. But there you go. Yeah, well, you know, he's middle aged now. God bless him.
Yeah, but wow, he did not take good care of himself. If he was a woman, I mean, people would have been like, I mean, there's no way he would never work again.
well, now, if you're not watching The Office, maybe you're reading comics, Karen. I know you're a big.
And we're going with this one too.
Yeah, well, cartoonist Rich Berlew headed to the fundraising site Kickstarter in order to raise money for reprints of his webcomic, The Order of the Styx. He hoped to raise $57,500, but a combination of fan demand and especially Berlew's constant interaction with them via email and text resulted in Berlew ultimately raising a cool $1.2 million. 8-10% goes to Kickstarter and Amazon, and it's all taxable, of course, but Berlew received pledges from nearly 15,000 people, a great number even for many titles from DC or Marvel. He sold tens of thousands of titles, including reprints and coloring books, and will have money left over to keep creating the series that brought fans to him in the first place. It's the first book project to raise more than $1 million at Kickstarter, and only the third overall, with the other two being a video game and a project to build an iPhone dock. And ironically, all of those projects were listed and raised that money in the month of February, days apart. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
This is a big deal, because Kickstarter is going to start to be a very big deal. Actually, you can tell it already is in the creative community in terms of getting movies made, getting comics financed. It's a big deal. But actually, you know where I thought you were going to go with this? The Archie Comics gay comic book.
No, not at all.
Oh, yeah, no.
But thank you for filling us in on that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Michael, what do you think? Big deal or big whoop?
I bought the wedding issue of the Archie comic book, but I'd say this is a it's more of a big whoop in a way, because I think people can't see this as the silver bullet that's going to, hey, everybody can just go out and raise a ton of money for their comic book or their novel or their movie. It's not going to work that way. It takes a very special person who already has a fan base, who already has a track record, who's really good at promoting themselves online in order to draw in that money and funds to do it. And that's also a lot of work. So it's great for him. It's great for anybody else who's that entrepreneurial, but it's not going to replace, you know, publishing houses and other people who need to fund creative works, because not everybody is a great self-promoter.
Need? I completely disagree with that word.
Ooh, absolutely a fight, not.
You
a fight.
You don't need publishing houses. You don't need studios anymore, because now you people have access to Kickstarter and similar that, and they can get people to finance their endeavors in different ways.
Well, you need a studio if you want to make a $150 million movie. If you want to make a summer franchise,
well, you need a studio. You need a studio if you want to make a movie that's going to cost you $150 million to make. You don't need a studio if you want to make a movie that's going to net you $150 million.
That's true. But you know, it will probably be a studio that releases it.
I disagree. The studios will be clamoring for that artist, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to get that particular property. They will probably get that artist's next property.
Well, then, Michael and Karen, what do you think that Kickstarter is expected to provide more funding to the arts this year than the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA? I guess the NEA's budget is $146 million, and this year Kickstarter is expected to raise $150 million.
Oh, that's very interesting.
I think that's great. You know,
yeah, it's a shame the NEA doesn't have more money.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And I'm curious to know about the politics behind that one, too.
The politics.
They always like to cut the NEA, the Republicans. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and before we get into politics, maybe we should move along into American Idol, which has been falling in the ratings ever since its season debut. Last week, Idol was beaten by both NCIS and The Big Bang Theory, and it barely held off The Voice. That's right. Idol wasn't the top regular show of the week, and it wasn't even the top-rated show on Thursday night. Idol always dips during Hollywood Week and the choosing of the top finalists, but now the ratings better rise significantly or the record-breaking 8 seasons at number 1 will be coming to an end very soon. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I've always been saying, hey, wait until the ratings are in. Wait until the season's over. You can't jump to every little blip in the ratings and say, Idol's over, Idol's over. But it looks like that 8-season run at number 1 might end. It's the longest in history. It had to end sometime. It'll still be a big, important top 10 show, but this will be a real change in the guard.
Karen?
Yeah, I agree. The only big deal here is that so many people clearly consider Idol to be a big whoop. I love The Voice, personally. Michael, do you watch it?
I've started to watch it a little bit. I'm still not a big fan. I liked The X Factor. I thought the talent on The X Factor was better than anything I've seen on either Idol or The Voice. But, you know, no matter what happens, it looks like the number one show in the country will not even reach 20 million people, which is probably the first time in history that the number one show in the country for a season is not reached kind of a broad audience. So it's been, down from the 80s with ER and The Cosby Show, clearly down from the 60s and 50s when, you know, I Love Lucy would reach 40 million people or whatever. This is a real changing of the world where there's so many cable channels, so much other ways to watch television that you just don't reach 20 million people anymore.
And there doesn't seem to be an Adam Lambert in the bunch, you know? I mean, I would argue that American Idol peaked when Adam Lambert lost.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly in the ratings-wise, you'd probably be right. Maybe there's a couple people I thought it looked really bad during the auditions, but maybe Philip Phillips or Erica Van Pelt or Jessica Sanchez or Jeremy, maybe one of those guys can pull it together.
I think they have a lot of really talented people who are nice to look at and kind of interesting, but you just don't have a megastar in the bunch. Not that I can see yet.
Well, and the show's just boring because the judges literally are afraid to say even the slightest negative comment. They've switched from being positive to simply being mealy-mouthed. I mean, they literally never – the worst thing they say is, I hope America can see how talented you are, which means you were terrible.
Yeah. I mean, at least with a voice, they give constructive criticism in a nice way.
Well, you know, I actually saw one of the judges at my child's kindergarten class. She was dropping off both of her children. And I really just wanted to say, Jenny, you wear that amazing dress to the Oscars and you come to kindergarten dressed in, like – sweatpants and a sweatshirt and a knit cap? Come on.
Since when do you call her Jenny?
Well, you know, now their kids go to, you know, the same school.
Why can't she drop off her kids wearing sweatpants?
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
You're sexist.
You know, all
no,
I can...
I just think it's bizarre. I mean, what is she going to wear? I mean...
I'd like to see her wear that dress.
Yeah, you just want to see the nip slip.
You know, according to Jenny, my new friend Jenny, there was no nipple.
I saw it. Didn't you guys?
Yes. I saw a piece, a little bit of naughtiness.
Yeah, okay. And I commented it all the time. It was clearly there.
Well, I have to go back and rewind, I suppose.
Yeah, you really should.
Well, speaking of rewinding, the on again, off again sequel to Ghostbusters is not happening. Again, Dan Aykroyd confirms that Bill Murray just isn't interested and that no one else wants to make the movie without him. And this is a quote. At this point, it's in suspended animation. The studio, the director, Ivan Reitman, and Harold Ramis feel there must be a way to do it, but Bill Murray will not do the movie. He doesn't want to be involved, Aykroyd explained to the London's Telegraph. And he continued the quote by saying, he's got 6 kids, houses all over America. He golfs in these tournaments where they pay him to turn up and have a laugh. He's into this life and living it. I know we'd have a lot of fun, but I can't be mad at him. He's a friend first, a colleague second. We have a deep personal relationship that transcends business, and he doesn't want to know. So, no Ghostbusters 3. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Oh, this is a big whoop. Every time any of these guys get interviewed, they're asked, will there be a new Ghostbusters movie? There was a Ghostbusters 2, of course, but we all want to forget about that. And they all say, maybe, I don't know, perhaps, if there's a good script, you never know, it might happen. You know, so then every 6 months, there's a headline about Ghostbusters is happening, or it's not happening, or it's happening. You know, I like Dan Aykroyd's quote, though. He makes it sound like Bill Murray is sitting at home playing golf. He's got a lot of movies. He just doesn't want to make this movie. So if they had a good script, I'm sure he'd say, hey, this is hilarious. Let's do it. But that's clearly not the case.
Does Darren? Bill Murray really have a lot of movies?
Well, he's certainly active. He's certainly busy. I mean, he's got Hyde Park on Hudson coming out, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. That's a Roman Coppola's movie. He's obviously works with Wes Anderson. You know, he's always got movies in play. Moonrise Kingdom is the new Wes Anderson film. He's in that movie. You know, he's always got stuff in development.
Yeah, I more power to him, though, if he is sitting around playing golf. I mean, he certainly deserved it. He, from what I understand, he hesitates before ever committing to any kind of movie. And even after he commits to a movie, it's like you don't really know if he's going to show up.
Is he sort of a Warren Beatty?
Yes.
Yeah, no, exactly. He is. And this is a big whoop for these athletes. Like you said, Michael, and it would have to be one hell of a funny script in order to get remade anyway.
I mean, it's a great movie, Ghostbusters. I think it's one of the best, you know, comedies, certainly big budget comedies like this ever. And they spoiled it with the sequel. Why spoil it again unless you're really convinced you're going to make a good movie?
Yeah.
Well, you're right, Karen. I mean, Jim Jarmusch tells that story of getting him to star in, I think it was Broken Flowers, and that he had no idea whether Bill Murray was going to show up and do this film.
Yeah, same thing with Zombieland.
Yeah, okay, so there you go. Now, if I were thinking on my feet, I would have jumped immediately to this next story after our American Idol story, since we were talking about Jennifer Lopez and the Oscars, because really, are the Oscars boring? Don't answer that, Karen. Okay, the Oscar ceremony has always been boring, but this year, with the Super Bowl drawing 113 million people and even a playoff game drawing 53 million, the Academy has to face the fact that the Oscars, with 39.3 million viewers, is a second-tier event. Heck, even the Grammys beat that figure this year. Dominated by small movies that most viewers hadn't even seen, the Oscars ceremony simply couldn't dominate the way it did even in the 1990s when popular movies like Forrest Gump and Gladiator and Titanic kept viewers tuned in. The show faced competition from basketball's All-Star Game, and Academy President Tom Sherrick said the mid-level ratings for the show are the new normal. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
You know, it's a big whoop. I mean, that's just a fact. It's like you were saying with The Office, you know, those numbers are down too. There's less people watching specific shows or less people watching TV in general because they have so many other things to do. And frankly, the Oscars are boring. I mean, I watch them religiously, but they're boring.
So Michael, Karen is an Oscar-ite. You know, she just said she's a religion joke there. What about you, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. In a way, I mean, it's still the number one TV show of the week. It's still one of the biggest shows of the year. It's still extremely profitable. The Grammy thing was a fluke. Oscars will probably be well ahead of it next year in the ratings. And I think it all comes down to the story we did on Academy membership.
Oh, yeah.
They don't want to open the floodgates to new members. They want to keep the door closed. That's why they have their median age is 62 and they're all white. 92% of them are white. They're old white people.
You can always tell by who wins best movie.
Who wins best movie and who's nominated. If they would open up their membership and have double their membership in 5 years, get more diversity, you'd see movies like Harry Potter be in the mix. Not that I thought it was one of the best movies of the year, but a lot of people did. And you'd have more popular, smart, younger, edgier movies and more interesting competitions, more suspense about what happens. Instead, you always know it's the old, boring people who are going to win.
Well, now, speaking of old white people, Billy Crystal did this, and I'm not saying Billy Crystal's an old white person. He did this.
But he is.
Yeah. He's white. He's old.
He did this Sammy Davis Jr.
He's a person.
And too much work done.
Whoa, did he ever? Oh, my God. Oh,
it's so sad. I mean, they flashed up wives in the audience sometimes, and it's so upsetting. I guess you don't notice it, but the work people do, the actresses and the wives and the people, it's just horrifying. It just they look bizarre. I guess they don't look that weird if you're in LA, but for the rest of America, I see glimpses of these people and think, oh my God, did you look in the mirror? I mean, it looks just
scary.
They look
like Halloween masks.
Yeah.
Well, did you think that his bit where he impersonated Sammy Davis Jr. was as controversial as everybody's saying? I guess he got some criticism for doing quote unquote blackface. Now, Sammy Davis Jr. was one of the bits he did on Saturday Night Live for years, and I guess it just goes to show you how, I guess, politically correct we now are, where in the 70s he can do this bit and nobody says a word and he doesn't.
Well, he wasn't on in the 70s.
Well, okay, the 80s. And then he does the same bit during the Oscars in the 2010s and everybody's up in arms.
Well, I'm sure people were offended at the time.
Oh, okay.
You know, I doubt that it was just, you know, I think it's in context, I think it's good natured and positive and meant in the spirit of things. I think it's obviously a dangerous thing, you know, but Robert Downey Jr. gets away with it in Tropic Thunder. I think in context as a tribute to an old showbiz legend, I think Billy Crystal's thing is seen in the proper spirit. It's certainly not to displace somebody and not give them work, but maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm being insensitive loud.
Yeah, no, I agree with you though. It was, you know, Billy Crystal can get away with a lot. And I think it wasn't meant, you know, to be mean. To me, the only thing that struck me as weird is, why was it there?
Yes, I agree. I was like, really?
Yeah, well, and you know, I thought he had mean jokes about Christopher Plummer. You know, it's about to be his grandest moment of his career, and Billy Crystal's making jokes about him being so old he doesn't know where he is and wandering off. I thought that was mean-spirited.
I don't remember that. Really?
Yeah.
He does have some zingers in there.
Wait, did he zingers say that is before a nice way to put or it. After Christopher Plummer made his own joke about being old?
Billy Crystal said Christopher Plummer might be walking up on stage tonight. But of course, he's so old, he wanders off all the time.
That's terrible.
It was obnoxious. But anyway, I thought that was more offensive than the Sammy Davis Jr. tribute, which he's done many times. And not that doing something many times makes it okay, but
frankly, it really wasn't that funny.
No, it wasn't.
Nothing he did was funny.
Well,
anyway, he was terrible.
Can we please put the Oscars to rest?
Well, then moving on. HBO's hit series True Blood is about to start a fifth season. The show may live forever, just like Vampires, the vampires that fill its storylines. But creator Alan Ball says the new season will be his last. True Blood has been and will continue to be a highlight of not only my career, he says, but my life. The creator of 6 Feet Under and, by the way, an Oscar winner for American Beauty, Ball has numerous deals in place with HBO and a new series called Banshee over at Cinemax. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Oh, I thought it was Karen's turn to be first. I would say it is a big deal in this sense. The show's been on for 5 years. It'll probably continue just fine without him. But I always complain when TV creators have a hit show and then they start to do 5 or 6 or 8 other projects and don't concentrate on that show. He's been with the show for 5 years and he's given his full undivided attention to it. And now he's ready to move on. And that's what you should do when you create Gilmore Girls or you create, American Idol or anything. You should stay with it. Make it as good as you can. Like Glee, that's who I'm thinking of. Ryan Murphy on Glee, who's got a reality show. He's got American Horror, you know, X, and he's ruining Glee. Glee's fallen off the charts creatively because he didn't concentrate on his hit show. So I'm very proud of Alan Ball, even though I'm not a big fan of the show, that he stuck to it, did not get distracted by all the offers that probably came his way, and, you know, stayed with the show for 5 years.
Wait, I think you just mixed a whole bunch of shows. American Horror X. Karen,
Ryan Murphy dumped you know, created Glee, had a big hit, and then he got himself distracted by doing American Horror on FX, on doing his reality show spinoff of Glee and other projects, instead of focusing on the show that got him there and making sure it could be a really great show.
Karen?
And I would argue that you could put Shonda Rhimes in there too, actually.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Private Practice is a dreadful show. She dropped the ball on Grey's Anatomy tremendously. And that's what happens. The network throws you all this money and says, hey, do other shows. And you lose the thread of the show that you, you know, how often do you get a chance to make a great show? Stick with it and make it as good as you can.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that this was a big whoop because I do kind of believe it's a big whoop. I think it's perfectly normal that a show creator usually does leave after about 5 years. But then after listening to you, Michael, I agree. It's a big deal because of how long he stayed.
Yeah, or at least stayed actively involved. He would have obviously kept his name on it for those 5 years, but he didn't get distracted with 18 other projects.
I mean, how long was Shonda Rhimes? Like, I don't know. She might actively still be with Grey's, but it
oh, absolutely. But, you know, when you're doing two shows at once, you know, it's crazy.
She was doing three. Remember, she did that Jungle one, too. And now she's got the new Kerry Washington one coming up. Scandal.
That's right. Grey's Anatomy started in 2005, and two seasons later, Private Practice came on board.
Yeah, and that was awful. And then, what, 2 years after that was the Jungle one, which I am probably the only person who watched and enjoyed.
I forget what Off the Map.
Yeah, I really like that show.
That was in 2011. And now this season she has Scandal, which had an okay pilot that I saw.
It doesn't look that good. I don't think Kerry Washington can carry a TV show. She's too cold.
We shall see.
Yeah.
Recently, we told you that Random House was the only one of the big six publishers who would be selling their ebooks to libraries without restrictions. However, that does come with a price because librarians just found out that Random House is tripling the price they charge libraries to buy those copies of ebooks. Like every other ebook, the ones sold by Random House will only be loaned out one at a time. In other words, you can't buy one ebook and make it digitally available to, say, 1,000 readers at the same time. Libraries have very long waits for their ebook editions at the moment and want to buy more copies but squawk at the huge price increase. Random House says, since the books will never wear out, unlike physical copies, that in the long run, this could be cheaper for libraries. Big deal or big whoop, Karen?
Wow, I didn't know this. It's a big deal because this is the wave of the future.
Michael?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal, too. The libraries just think Random House is just trying to stick it to them and treating ebooks differently. But I do think the idea that, you know, it's not true for most authors because most books wouldn't be borrowed enough to have them wear out. But when you've got like a best-selling author like Stephen King, I think then it could make sense to charge more for the ebook because they can keep loaning them out perpetually. Whereas some other publishers say after 36 loans, you got to buy a new copy or some. They all have random restrictions that they place on it. Random House says you have it forever, you know, for 100 years. You can keep loaning out this ebook.
Yeah, they have a really good point.
Yeah, so I think it's for a best-selling author, it makes sense. It does not make sense for every book that they put out because 99% of them are not going to be that popular.
But then how do you define best-selling author? I mean, are they considered best-selling author after X number of books that they've sold?
Yeah, you would
do it. Track record or the first printing, you know, if they're printing out 100,000 copies or 50,000 copies, that may not even apply anymore since we have ebooks now. But I'd say track record in the past. If they break an author, then their next book, they can say, all right, this is a best-selling author. But Stephen King, John Grisham, Diane Steele, all that sort of stuff. You know, okay,
Danielle,
maybe you can charge a premium.
You are just mixing all kinds of names today.
Well, you know, that's exactly, I would agree with you. I mean, Ania Vardalos, I know I always get her name wrong.
No, that's
but
right.
The reason My Big Fat Greek Wedding stayed in movie theaters, and I know we're kind of mixing mediums here, but the reason that movie stayed in movie theaters for so long is because when it was released, the movie theaters got such a good deal on renting that movie because it was basically a whole bunch of unknowns in this movie, except for John Corbett. And when it started taking off, the movie theaters were making a ton of money. So they just kept it around. Well, I think the same is true. You know, you buy a book at cost for some unknown author, it takes off. You know, the next book that author publishes, you're going to get dinged for. It's going to cost three times as much.
Yeah.
But I have to say, you know, just trying to kind of squeeze, you know, the fact that you can't loan the book out to 1,000 readers, they're trying to take a digital medium and make it work in the real world. Those are two totally different worlds. They should really, they should rethink the model. Yes. Thank you.
Well, I think they are in a way. They're saying, all right, we're going to charge you three times as much, but you'll have a copy forever. That's one way of rethinking it.
That is correct.
The others are saying, well, it'll wear out after a certain time. I mean, it's not fair to say, hey, you pay $30 for an ebook copy and then you can sell it, you can loan it out to every single customer that the New York Public Library has. They'd never, yes, they'd have to buy one copy and everybody would just get the ebook instantly and not have to wait in line. That would be, you know, a nightmare for the publishers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, I mean, we all know that the publishers need to rethink what their business model is, but it looks like the library does well. Yeah. I mean,
They're desperately trying to get people to donate e-readers and tablets to them so that they, people who don't have e-readers and tablets can access digital books. Hmm. They're trying to figure out ways to make ebooks available to their readers because a lot of people come in and say, I want ebooks. And they're like, well, we can't buy 800 copies of ebooks, A, because they put all these restrictions on them, or they charge three times as much, and you're cutting our library budget. So they're really between a rock and a hard place right now.
Oh, I hope the library doesn't go away.
Yeah, where will the homeless people go?
They'll probably be the last man standing.
There are absolutely no homeless people in the library that I go to. I go to the Beverly Hills Library.
Well, I go to the, yeah, well. Yeah, if they are homeless people, they're
very well dressed.
Yeah, exactly. They're there to check their email. In any case, speaking of changing models and changing their behavior, the week after Showbiz Sandbox told you that full access to TV shows for cable subscribers on any screen, anytime, anywhere was inevitable, the head of Time Warner has said the same thing. So CEO Jeff Bukes told investors that TV everywhere must become the standard and soon. Customers don't just expect it, he said, they demand it. And if you don't give it to them, they'll go elsewhere. In other words, it's not just a way to compete with Netflix or Hulu, it's really essential to survive. He also chided the Nielsen rating system for not capturing the full audience for TV shows wherever and however they watch them, whether it be a tablet or in sports bars. And I guess he also went on to kind of defend Ultraviolet and the way it was launched. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, you've got three issues in there. I would say it's a big deal about taking Nielsen to task. They've got to start capturing TV viewership everywhere, no matter how it happens.
I can't believe that they're not, you know? I mean, that should have started years ago.
How do you measure TV audience at a bar?
You can measure downloads, so you can measure the people who are watching it on, or streaming, you know, you can measure people who are watching it on a tablet.
That's easier, absolutely. But as far as TV everywhere, yeah, I think you talk about rethinking your business model. I think he's smart to do it here. He's saying, yeah, look, we have to make this available. It's not just a good idea. It's what you have to do to survive because this is how people want it. And he's recognizing
that. I wish he would put his money where his mouth is because I'm a Time Warner subscriber and I can't get most of the stuff online. Whereas Comcast, I have to say, is doing a better job.
And even if you can get it on your tablet, you have to be in your home. God forbid you be, you know, down the street.
Now, do we need to do a full disclosure on the Comcast comment?
Yeah, I do social media for Comcast. But okay. All you have to do is just look it up. I mean, they're definitely making better strides in that area than Time Warner is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've even said here on the show that Comcast is progressive in that area.
Everyone can do much better.
Well, and what do you think of this whole Blu-ray, listen to me, this whole Ultraviolet thing where they launched it and he actually says, yeah, we you know, should we have waited until it was perfect? Well, you know, the reason we didn't, and this is a quote, the reason we didn't is consumers are used to seeing these new products improve over time. They know version 3.0 is going to be better than 1.0. And I just thought, are you kidding me?
Yes. We want to make a bad version so we can make it better.
Yeah, this whole Ultraviolet.
Ultraviolet is a digital option where if you buy a Blu-ray or DVD, you typically get a copy where you can also digitally download it or have it accessible via the cloud.
Right.
It's just a new way of portability rather than you having to physically download it onto your computer, which you can still do in most cases, and then put it on your tablet or your phone or your laptop. In this way, you can access it via an internet connection no matter where you are. So it's just an easier way of making your movies portable.
In the end, I think this will hurt the people who actually pay for movies rather than the people who pirate it. But and the way it was launched, I spoke with somebody who was behind the launch and he was just saying, I probably shouldn't say which company he works for, but he was just saying, look, it's our technology that helped launch this thing. And they just botched the launch. And now it's better. But he just said, we told them not to do it, and they did it anyway, and they were trying to beat Key Chest, this Disney product that does the same thing, and they screwed it up.
It's a good idea to always improve your product, but it's also a good idea to make sure it's pretty good to start.
That's correct.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what is Facebook's mantra? Good enough is better than not out there, or I forget the second part of it, but
yeah,
I mean, this wasn't even good enough. But, you know, speaking of TV everywhere, it was just, I just read this morning, is it Fios? Somebody is suing Time Warner and other companies for even using the phrase TV everywhere.
Somebody has copyright on TV everywhere.
Yeah. I think Michael owns that copyright. Hopefully it's not Mike Tyson, who's going to be over in Vegas. You know, if William Shatner, who, by the way, I'm seeing on Saturday night, his Broadway show, which is coming to Los Angeles, but he was just a star on Broadway, and if he can do it, why not Mike Tyson in Las Vegas? That seems to be the thinking behind putting the boxer on stage at the MGM Grand in a one-man show about his life. Ah, the ear-biting, the prison sentence for rape, the allegations of wife-beating, the squeaky high voice, and the poetry. Sounds like a hit! The show runs for 6 nights in April. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think this is a big deal, Sperling. I think it's going to be really good.
Karen, what about yourself?
I care so little about this that I'm going to say big whoop just after hearing Mike Tyson. I'm like, big whoop.
I mean, it sounds, the only interest would be as a train wreck. I'd find it the whole thing unpleasant.
Well, I'd make fun of the whole idea, but I fear he does live in Los Angeles. He's going to find me and kick my
ass. Yeah, better not talk about this.
Well, that actually kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. And Karen, thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
You guys, it was I'm so happy to be back. You guys should invite me back more often.
Well, hey, you're welcome back anytime, as they say on every single talk show, by the way. I don't know if you've noticed that. Come back anytime and join us, including when you don't have a movie to plug.
Including when you're like the worst guest possible.
Well, speaking of plugging things, you're on Twitter, of course. Karen Woodward, right?
Karen _ Woodward, because Karen Woodward is some actress who has taken that handle and never tweeted.
I say we find she's probably in Los Angeles, Karen. We should get together, go find her, get Mike Tyson to beat her up.
No, she's not. She's not even in L.A. She's like doing like local theater in like Massachusetts.
Can you direct tweet her and say, hey, darling,
I never heard back. She's not on there. She's not even on Twitter enough to check her DMs.
Well, is there anything? Oh, KarenWoodwardOnline.com, of course, is your website.
No, I got to be honest with you. All I've been doing lately is work. There's nothing exciting and new to plug. I'm on Karen _Woodward at Twitter. I'm online at Karen Woodward Online. What else do I normally plug? That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Well, you have a job, right? So that's pretty exciting.
Do you have a job? It's very exciting.
Well,
and I hang out with my cat, Ted, who anybody who is Facebook friends with me knows that I talk about him all the time. The neighbor's cat, actually.
Oh, my God.
You follow him at Borrowed Ted.
You should start a TV show, a companion to Wilfred. Yours could be Ted, and it could be with a cat.
Yeah, it could be.
We'll get together and write the pilot.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Karen, for taking the time to sit down with us and do Big Deal or Big Whoop this week.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, it was fun to have Karen stop in.
Yeah, it's always fun to talk to her. And I guess I kind of miss the back and forth of Big Deal, Big Whoop between you two each week. So I was actually happy to just sit back and listen. Now, we should move along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, we kind of touched on this last week. This week, the story kind of blew up a little bit more, as, in my opinion, is expected when you have the Weinstein Company trying to gain or get publicity for one of their independent titles. In this case, the title is Bully. An NC-17 rating was, it wasn't given an NC-17 rating. Well, no, it was given an R rating, and they said, we're going to withdraw it from the MPAA. We don't want it rated.
Oh, I see. Right. Because it had a certain number of F words, and there's sort of an automatic knee jerk. If you have 4, 6, or 8, then it becomes an R-rated film, just like The King's Speech, the Oscar-winning film from last year, which the Weinsteins bitched a little bit about, though that's obviously a very different film geared towards adults. There are no teenagers waiting to see The King's Speech. But this film, Bully, is geared to be seen by high school students to talk about bullying.
That's right. And it received an R rating because of its language. And, you know, Harvey Weinstein, being Harvey Weinstein, said, that is it. We're dropping out of the MPAA, which, by the way, they don't technically belong to. And so
what he's saying, they would stop submitting their movies for a rating.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, that's pretty significant.
That is significant. Yes. And, you know, NATO, the National Association of Theater Owners, the CEO, John Fithian, who, by the way, was on the show in January, a couple weeks ago, he said, quote, he would have no choice but to encourage my theater owner members to treat unrated movies from the Weinstein Company in the same manner as they treat unrated movies from anyone else. In most cases, that means enforcement as though the movies were rated NC-17, where no one under the age of 18 can be admitted, even with accompanying parents or guardians.
Right. So, you know, they're sort of upping the ante because they don't want to have to deal with movies and try to deal with them on a case-by-case basis, because then everybody would say, deal with my movie on a case-by-case basis, and it would become a nightmare for theater owners all over the country, and you'd have regional boards ranking movies just like you did in the old days. On the other side, you have Reverend Jesse Jackson releasing a statement or somehow urging the ratings board to reverse Bully's R rating and saying that they should, in fact, make it PG-13. And he says, quote, Bully is a movie that depicts the nightmare that some kids face every day in schools across America. This harsh reality must not be edited, especially considering how bullying has become a horrible form of violence. It drives individuals to suicide and even retaliation. It creates violent reactions in our children. They must be allowed to see the movie as it was intended, to help raise awareness, increase empathy, and change minds.
And meanwhile, we're all talking about Bully, a Weinstein Company film.
Well, but they did not make a minor documentary film about bullying in order to become rich. And I have to say, I got a petition online from friends. There was somebody who started a Facebook pledge saying, hey, please do this. Or I think it was on change.org. Somebody sent me a link to it. I actually didn't sign it because I haven't seen the movie. Maybe it deserves an R rating. I have no idea. I assume they made it for high school students. I assume it would be appropriate to show to high school students. I assume they see a lot worse every week when they're home online. But I feel silly saying a movie deserves a certain rating when I haven't seen it yet.
Right. Well, and you're right. There was a petition. Katie Butler, a Michigan high school student, put it up online on change.org. On Monday, last night, it had over 200,000 signatures on its way to 300,000, which is what they're hoping to get, which is pretty significant.
Absolutely.
And, you know, a couple points here. In his letter to the Weinstein Company, John Fithian says that, you know, having gone through this whole thing with the King's speech just the year before, that Harvey Weinstein knew the rules about language at the MPAA. They knew the MPAA rules about language.
Well, they say there are no rules.
That's
they say
the
every
thing.
Movie is taken on their own basis, but everybody knows that there's a knee-jerk reaction to sex over violence, even if it's positive, intimate, conjugal, marital sex, and also a knee-jerk reaction to a certain number of language. If you use this word X number of times, you're going to be in trouble. Even though they claim there are no rules, there are no standards, everything is taken in context. And the argument of the Weinsteins is, put the movie in context. Look at the King's speech and say, there's one scene, one use of comedic effect does not deserve an R rating. Or in this sense, it's a film created to talk about bullying, in which case you talk about the mean things people say, put it in context and compare it to, say, Scarface.
Right. And I guess, you know, there are no rules. And that's really the point I wanted to make, is that John Fithian, who is the kind of theater owner's side to the MPAA, he does the same job, but on the theater side, he knows there are no rules. I mean, you can't say, well, we know we were breaking the law because we had 14 F-bombs.
Well, he knows that in practice there are rules.
Right.
That there are, you know, certain guidelines and things that are going to kick in, even though officially there are no rules. So he's speaking to the reality of it rather than the malarkey MPA claim that there are no rules and that they treat every movie individually.
Now, and speaking of reality, you know, if Harvey Weinstein really wanted to get this film into the hands of teenagers, he could do the exact same thing he did with The King's Speech, which is bleep out or clean up
All mocked that, and it was against the filmmaker's wishes, and it was a minor release after it had made most of its money, and it made no money, and nobody wanted to see it. And if you want to talk to kids about bullying and what's happening, bleeping it would arguably, you know, dilute the impact of what's being said and done and therefore make the movie seem more of a joke to kids.
Possibly. But I guess what I'm
right.
saying
but
is
he didn't, what he did was against the filmmaker's wishes. It made no money and everybody mocked it. So to say he should repeat something that he was mocked for doesn't make a lot of sense.
OK, good point. Good point. So, well, I mean, we'll see how this plays out.
But I don't mean to bully you, but I just.
We'll see how this plays out. I'm sure it won't be the last time we hear Harvey Weinstein arguing about a rating, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we had a story a couple of, maybe it was the last episode or two episodes ago, about Arrow TV, which is this over-the-air service that's launching only in New York City on March 14th. And we got a ton of email from listeners to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's our email address, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And so for all the listeners who wrote in and asked either for further explanation of Arrow or in some cases like Brandon Haworth from New York, he actually provided an explanation of how the company's service works. We actually have an update for you.
Well, we didn't fully explain how it works because it was sort of a technical cutesy wink wink workaround to try and make it legal. If I wanted to set up a streaming service, I could not start streaming the major networks over the internet.
No, you can't.
I don't have the right to do that. But what I can do is individually, perhaps, stream via antenna, send you directly to your antenna the over-the-air antenna information that's provided free by law. All the major networks go out over the air. So if you set up an antenna, you can get a signal. And what this company is doing is setting up little micro arrays of tiny little antennas in different parts of New York City and then sending them out to all the different homes that subscribe. Now, they don't technically have an antenna for every single subscriber, but they say based on usage and this and that and the other thing that you are essentially just getting a booster antenna signal from one of these little tiny antennas included in this array. And therefore, they say, we're not streaming it over the internet. We're just helping boost the antenna signal that people are legally allowed to access. And therefore, we can provide the major networks to our customers via this new service.
Well, yeah, I mean, think about it this way. You know, your rabbit ears, let's say in your living room, the rabbit ears don't work. So you go all the way up onto the roof and you stick the rabbit ears up on top of the roof. Of your apartment building, and you run that cord all the way down into the back of your TV set. Well, rather than run that cord all the way into your TV set, what Arrow is doing is, as you say, Michael, they've got these little micro antennas. They're the size of a dime, and they place tens of thousands of these on these boards that they then, you know, have all
put around the city.
They have them on street lights and telephone poles and
top of buildings.
And then so that's the antenna that's collecting the signal.
And that's sort of just a cute technological way to try and make legal something that wouldn't be legal if they did it the more direct way, which would be to stream it over the internet. They're
right.
Trying to go use a loophole in the law in order to make this service available. And frankly, that's all it is. It's a loophole that they're trying to exploit. And whether a courts will say, yes, it's a loophole and you're making legal use of it, or they'll say, nice try, not going to pass.
I guess the real key here is whether beaming the signal from this micro antenna array to the antenna that Arrow gives you to place in your home, in other words, there's no wire in between them, whether that's seen as being the same as having a wire.
Well, what I don't get is how they're going to get that signal to you, because antennas are really hard to use in New York City because of the tall buildings. So it's not clear to me whether they have an antenna at the top of the building like DirecTV does for their satellite.
Or just nearby.
Yeah, I'm not sure. No, I know that they'll have them nearby, but then how does it get to my apartment window? Because do I have it in my window or do I have it on the roof? Or I'm just not sure how they get the signal to you, because that's what the problem is with antenna signals. They're hard to get through the canyons of New York.
Well, what
so
they
I'm not
do
quite
is,
sure how it works technically.
Yeah, I mean, they give you this little box that has a micro antenna, just one micro antenna in it, that receives the signal from this micro antenna array that's out there on the top
right,
of the building.
But that doesn't work very well. So I'm not sure how well it's going to work technically.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess even beyond that, once that signal, if it should get into your home, you know, if it hypothetically doesn't have a problem, they then beam the signal from that their little micro antenna device in your home to your computer or your iPad.
Your tablet.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not even on a TV, which I think is kind of interesting.
Well, you can put it on a TV, can't you?
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, well, and, you know, as you say, the courts are going to get involved because PBS, Fox, Univision, WPIX in New York, ABC, CBS, and NBC Universal have all gone to court to seek an injunction and are saying this is not legal. You know, this is, as you say, a workaround, and it's not.
So it does include PBS, even though our original report seemed to not mention PBS.
Yes, correct. It does include PBS.
As well as Univision, which is appropriate since they are higher rated certain nights of the week than all the other networks. So, you know, they're right up there sometimes. So, you know, that's a large Latino audience. So that's interesting that they're part of it, too.
And they're not, you know, you can only do this in New York. So they're geofencing it. You have to have an IP address in New York. You have to have a mailing address that's in New York. So, you know, because they're going to charge $12 a month. So your credit card can't be in Los Angeles and you're getting New York stations. So, and it's only over the air. You can't get TNT or or HBO or anything that's broadcast over the air. Now, here's what I found interesting. Jay Rasulow, who is the CFO of Disney, he said to Wall Street analysts during a financial conference last week that ABC's switch from soap operas to lifestyle programming has been successful.
And this anything to do with this, or it's just a new story?
This is you'll see. He finished talking about ABC by saying that the retransmission fees for ABC can amount to $500 million annually in a few years. So originally, a broadcast television network got $0 as their retransmission fees. But then most people started getting cable and satellite, and rather than receiving their television over the air with rabbit ears or an antenna.
But I thought the major networks didn't get any money for that.
No, they do. That's the whole argument. That's why Fox, started blacking out their network into cable vision in New York. Broadcast networks originally did not get retransmission fees. However, now they are getting them. And at $500 million annually, you know, that's a lot of money to turn away.
You're saying that they don't get any retransmission fee from Arrow, and therefore that's another reason why they're fighting it.
That's right. I mean, because if all of a sudden Arrow makes it possible to get television...
But Arrow would have to pay retransmission fees for all the other channels they want to provide. They can't think they're going to survive on just providing the... They're trying to be just a little stepping stone for cutting the cord. If you can get the major networks, then you don't have to buy cable. Then you can use this Hulu and Netflix.
That's right. And all of the people who use Arrow will be receiving over the air. And the less and the fewer people who have cable, the lower the retransmission fees are for any network on cable, whether it be TNT or TBS or ESPN or ABC, NBC, CBS, broadcast networks, which traditionally and as late as 10 years ago never received retransmission fees. It was all free to cable networks and satellite providers.
Okay. And they're just starting to ratchet up the cost that they get. They still don't get anywhere near what like ESPN would get. But they're hoping to keep increasing the retransmission fees and get more and more money from cable and satellite providers. And therefore, they're all the more freaked out by people cutting the cord. And so they don't want to do anything that makes it easier for them, including something like Arrow, which lets you get all the major networks for free.
That's
just like you should be able to over the air.
Right. But you know what you can get for free? You can get Showbiz Sandbox for free.
All right.
All you have to do is subscribe at the iTunes Store or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher. You can also subscribe in your RSS reader or your favorite podcatcher. And please, on iTunes, the Zune Marketplace, on all of these different podcast aggregators, please do rate and review the show. It does help us out. You can find those links, as well as links to all of the stories we talked about in today's show, as well as ways to contact us. Again, dirt@showbizsandbox is our email address. You can also leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, we're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. On Twitter, we're Showbiz Sandbox. And on Facebook, we're Showbiz Sandbox. Please look us up, follow us, like us. All of that information, though, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com.
And they can be found in Central and South America in the next 2 weeks, in the next few weeks. In end of March and April, they are going to Central and South America. They're going to Chile, Buenos Aires, Brazil, Mexico City, winding up in Puerto Rico. That's all from March 31st through April 14th. So if you're in Central and South America, make sure you catch MGMT in concert.
Wow, maybe I should go. I'd like to see them in concert again.
Yeah.
Now, some of your work, Michael, can be found where?
Online at michaelgiltz.com. You can always find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Michael Giltz. And a lot of my writing right now is on Huffington Post. So if you go there and search for my name, you'll find a list of all the articles I've done for them.
I'm on Twitter as well. And you can find some of my writing at celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I miss Karen.